crash, bash, bash, blast the system. We wanna get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We want the crowd loud, fist pumping, rhythm is hitting. We wanna make it clear, we ain't scared. This is the vision we want, we want, we want, we want.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we'll talk about how the news media taught us to love censorship and hate journalism. We're joined by New York Times bestselling author and journalist, Cheryl Atkison. We'll talk about her new book, Slanted. Later in the program, we're rejoined by Rachel Jolly. Her new report for Reuters Institute is on innovation and a sharper focus, how local news is weathering the coronavirus storm. Today on the Project Censored Show, an hour about the state of our free press. Stay tuned.
Crimes perpetrated by the criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, of the apocalypse, got the skies looking ominous.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of today's program, we are delighted to bring to the Pacifica airwaves Cheryl Atkison. She's a New York Times bestselling author. Cheryl has been a working journalist for more than 35 years and is host and managing editor of the nonpartisan Sunday morning TV program, Full Measure with Cheryl Atkison. She's covered controversies under the administrations of Bill Clinton, George Bush, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and Donald Trump, emerging with a reputation, as the Washington Post recently put it, as a persistent voice of news media skepticism about the government story. Cheryl is the recipient of 5 Emmy Awards and an Edward R. Murrow Award for Investigative Reporting, and has worked at CBS News, PBS, CNN. Cheryl Atkison, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Well, I'm so glad to be here. Thank you, Mickey.
We've had you on once before. It's been a long time. Your newest book is called Slanted, How the News Media Taught Us to Love Censorship and Hate Journalism. And this is what I want to talk to you about today. Cheryl Atkison, your trajectory here from your last book, The Smear, through Slanted, there's definitely a theme here. There's a thread here. Can you make that connection for our listeners so we can set the frame for our conversation?
Sure. I didn't plan it that way, but now I guess you could look at these 3 books as a trilogy. I wrote Stonewalled when I quit CBS in 2014 ahead of my contract, seeing the direction the news industry was going and personally experiencing that it was tougher to get those great investigative stories on the news. Yes, I was still getting some on, but the great stories that were left, as they say, on the cutting room floor were heart-wrenching. And I saw the whole industry taking a turn, so I left. Then the next book, The Smear, really dissected this industry. And I spoke to a lot of smear artists. They're proud of it, by the way. I mean, I can't always call them by name in the book, but this is the group of influential people who work on behalf of corporate and political interests in this multi-billion dollar industry that pulls strings on the news and figured out how to get their nose under the tent at news organizations. I'm talking nonprofits and LLCs and corporate law firms and global law firms, PR firms, and so on. And now what we're talking about in Slanted is this end result, how it's never been clearer that so much of the news is reporting in a biased, one-sided, opinionated way that even 10 short years ago, 8 years ago, would have been frowned upon. Journalists would have been fired for some of the practices they're doing today that are being cheered on now by journalism groups and journalism colleges in some cases. So it sort of dissects where we've come from me looking ahead in 2014 and kind of seeing, maybe not knowing we ended up exactly here, but seeing that the devolution of the news industry was really happening.
What were some of the structural limitations and problems that you felt got in the way of investigative journalism?
Really not much till the end. To the end, what happened was the last few years at CBS, because I had great success before then with great bosses who could deflect a lot of these attempts to make the news be a tool of propagandists. But at the end, we were set up where we had a lot of the propagandists working in the newsrooms. The smear industry, as I described, they understood how to use social media to attack stories and journalists personally, to discredit them so that when the story comes out, people won't listen to them or won't believe them. They have these strategies and tactics that understood how to go to the corporate bosses at CBS and the advertising department, and that that's not supposed to trickle down to the news division, but it does. There were lawsuits at the corporate level that CBS was fighting that had nothing to do with the news division. And I found out in one case, a story of mine that got killed because it was a bargaining chip on a case we might have been losing at the corporate level. It's the same law firm that was fighting. In another case we were losing, we agreed not to air a certain story of mine, had nothing to do with the news division. So all kinds of those things are happening behind the scenes, and that really accelerated those last few years I was at CBS.
So, Cheryl Atkison, in your new book, Slanted, How the News Media Taught Us to Love Censorship and Hate Journalism, you begin by talking about the crafting of particular narratives, or what you actually call the narrative, and you actually have some apt Orwellian analogies, and that kind of sets the stage for your new book. Can you talk a little bit about what you mean about this particular industry narrative?
I first heard that term used when I was at CBS by some of these middle managers or managers who were actually pushing narratives, and I didn't understand. They kept saying stuff about narrative and agenda. I now use those terms all the time, but before this, I didn't even know what they meant when they would say, oh, somebody's pursuing a narrative or somebody's pursuing an agenda, when in fact they were, by the way. So it came to mean a lot to me, and I now understand and kind of define my usage of the word, the narrative. It's a storyline that powerful interests want promulgated. There may be grains of truth in the storyline. It doesn't mean the whole thing's a lie, but the way it's presented is in a one-sided fashion to the exclusion of any counterpoints or balance or opposing views to try to convince the public to think a certain way, usually because if you keep going all the way back, there's a financial interest that's pushing a narrative, maybe through nonprofits, maybe through what's supposed to look like a good meaning fact check or something like that. But there's usually money at the end of the road, why we're supposed to think a certain way and ignore certain scientific studies, but pay attention to others. And this is what I see as the narrative, sort of a one-sided storyline being furthered by these special interests in a way to manipulate or shape public opinion.
Could you talk to us about what you mean by the psychology of the narrative and your experience?
I think one thing I try to make people see is the whole information landscape is a result of this narrative that we're talking about, or this industry that pushes narratives. You may think, well, I watch different channels to get different views. I watch CNN, I watch Fox, I watch MSNBC. And even, by the way, on some of those stations, you have someone arguing one side and someone from the opposite political party arguing the other. So you may say to yourself, well, I'm well informed. But what I try to explain is you're still subjected to the narrative, because all the stuff you see on TV, the topics they're talking about, even if they're getting differing viewpoints, those topics are the things that these interests want before us on a given day. They want us talking about that story or that topic, which is why, if you watch the news or read the lead stories on the internet and news publications, you're often reading the same four or five stories over and over and over and over again. And there's thousands of stories that could be in the news in a given day. I mean, I look at what I used to cover when I worked at CNN back when it was a news organization in 1990. Most of our coverage had nothing to do with politics directly, but now that's pretty much all you see, as if that's the only thing happening in the world. And that's a result of this industry that has been very successful at getting us on point to talk about the stories and to pay attention to the ideas they want us to pay attention to.
And Cheryl Atkison, of course, at Project Censored, one of the main things we've been doing for over 40 years is covering the news that doesn't make the news and analyzing why. There are dozens of stories that the independent alternative press are covering all the time. And like you just said, they never break into this platform. Do you have like an example or two that you think are gold standards of your critique of what's going on with the press?
Sure. Up until about 2005, I at CBS and many other journalists at New York Times and the other networks were heavily covering prescription drug dangers. And of course, we all know prescription drugs do great things, wonderful things. Most people are taking some of them. But we also know and knew that many of them were being approved in sometimes a capricious manner, even according to FDA insiders, and were having serious side effects and dangers that were covered up and so on. That was a hugely popular topic until, and I only realized this in retrospect, it almost stopped overnight, and you'll hardly see those stories today, even though they impact millions and millions of people and they didn't go away. But in retrospect, the broadcast news industry, and I suppose the same is probably true of print, partnered with the pharmaceutical industry to lobby to to legalize direct-to-consumer ads, these TV ads of prescription drugs. A lot of people, maybe they're too young or don't remember, that used to be illegal. You weren't allowed to advertise prescription drugs on TV. I think only two countries allow it. And once we partnered with that industry and lobbied successfully to have these ads on TV, and our bread and butter became the pharmaceutical industry, and we knew that, we stopped those stories. The stories still exist, and these dangers and risks still happen. But if you try reporting on them, this powerful industry makes sure that you're controversialized and social media takes you down and that you're discredited. That's one of the biggest impacts and maybe the first ones I saw of a narrative. And it's so common now, what I'm about to say, that people probably don't give it a second thought. But I remember having a moment of wonderment and clarity back in around 2005 when the pharmaceutical industry was working behind the scenes to stop my stories at CBS. And they didn't want the stories to air. And that was a new thing. Used to be, they wanted their side represented. That's all good. You want to represent their side. But I had not yet encountered the notion that a particular study or idea or story should not be heard, should just be kept off the air so people don't even know that it exists because they might make the wrong decision about it. Now, this is where everything has come. But it was a foreign concept back then. So I think that's one of the best examples.
Even before that, the late 90s, Monsanto and the big flap with a local Fox affiliate in Tampa, Florida, the strange bedfellows and boards of directors and the behind-the-scenes influence that killed a story about Monsanto's Posilac having negative side effects that were getting through the milk supply. And two reporters, Jane Acree and Steve Wilson, were sacked, basically, for trying to report the story. That's like another example of these major entities. But even then, that was a censored story, not because no one heard it, but because what you were just saying is that it just didn't seem to generate media attention itself, which leads me to the next question. The corporate press, as an industry, seems to cover its own business the least. What have you seen from your life inside this industry? How well are these kind of critiques taken? Because I'm going to get to whistleblowing after the break, but in many regards, you're kind of a whistleblower on your own industry.
Well, we are very thin-skinned as an industry with the same sorts of criticism we are freely heap on other people. And my first experience with that was I got to CBS Washington, D.C. Bureau about the time that Bernard Goldberg, this was about the end of his time, but he wrote an op-ed of some kind that claimed there was this liberal bias at CBS and perhaps other networks. And when that got published, you'd have thought he was Hitler. I just remember walking in and people talking about him, calling him a traitor. And although they were not arguing some of the anecdotes that he told, which were completely true. And I remember thinking, and I said to somebody, and I was a new young kid, I'm sure that this didn't go over very well, but I said, boy, we sure can dish out criticism, but we can't take it. And by that, I meant, what was so wrong with somebody inside our industry saying we should be better at this or here's something we don't do well? We do that all the time to other people. And it was just the way he was treated for that really stuck in my head.
And that's something that we're going to spend some more time talking about here today on the Project Censored Show. I'd like to remind listeners that you are listening to Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff, host here of the Project Censored Show. I'm speaking with Emmy Award-winning and New York Times bestselling author and journalist Cheryl Atkison. Her program is Full Measure with Cheryl Atkison. And her newest book is titled Slanted, How the News Media Taught Us to Love Censorship and Hate Journalism. We're going to continue that conversation after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, in this segment, we're speaking with Cheryl Atkison, New York Times bestselling author and journalist. Cheryl Atkison has been a working journalist for over 30 years. Her current Sunday morning program is Full Measure with Cheryl Atkison, which is distributed by Sinclair Broadcasting. So just full disclosure there. We've done programs about Sinclair Broadcasting. And before the break, Cheryl, we were just talking about some of this tendency of the press to not critique itself. It's true that you are on Sinclair Broadcasting, and they're seen by many as a conservative network. But my question to you is, what kind of experience have you had working inside Sinclair with your own program?
Well, the good news is, after I quit CBS, I was prepared to never work in my industry again, because who's going to hire someone who talks about the industry and has critiqued it? Who's going to let me do the kind of reporting I used to do in this environment? But Sinclair, long story short, they called me, as I did get offered quite a few jobs, actually. And when Sinclair's head of news contacted me, my producer at CBS, who was going to leave and come work with me, whatever I ended up doing when her contract was up at CBS, she said, oh, I know the head of news there. He was my photographer back in Baltimore 35 years ago. You should call him. He's a great guy. So it's the only reason, I'd never heard of Sinclair, the only reason I returned that call. And in the end, Scott Livingston asked me to do a Sunday TV show that was, he said, just like I used to do at CBS, the stuff, the kind of reporting we used to do, accountability, whistleblowers, follow the money, government watchdogging, just all of my favorite stuff that was so successful at CBS. And I met with the then owner, David Smith. He spent a lot of time with me, and I didn't have to have the job. In fact, I was leaning toward not taking it unless I could really call all the shots. And I said to him, I knew that this was a conservative place. And I said, this can't be a conservative show. And I'm just not going to get locked into another situation where someone's interfering editorially, particularly in a dishonest way. And he just said, you just tell the truth. I don't even know that he watches the show, because when I asked, Scott Livingston says he goes to church at that time. So he's hands off, you know, we get to do everything we want. And when there's something that's slightly sensitive now, that wouldn't have been 10 years ago a news topic, but when it's sensitive now, gosh, at CBS, I got to the point where we self-censored so much and we knew everything was going to cause such pushback. I may have a little fleeting moment of, should I tell them? Is there an issue? There just isn't. It's just a wonderful place to be. And I get called every couple of weeks from a colleague of mine working elsewhere saying, how are you able just to do this normal news? And do you have any job openings? And sadly, I don't. It's very small staff, but we're a staff that's worked at BBC, CBS, ABC, Al Jazeera, and CNN. We can't believe the freedom we have. It's been wonderful.
So Cheryl Akison, that leads me to this, the idea, the problems of self-censorship, and one of the reasons that we really need not only investigative journalists, but we need brave sources often to come forward. You mentioned your interest in whistleblowing and whistleblowers, and in fact, that's where we met several years ago, 6 years ago now, in Washington, D.C., with some mutual friends at the National Whistleblower Summit, winning awards together there with Andy Lee Roth and I, and we met you there. We've stayed in touch with you and followed your work ever since. Because, again, one of the main things that stuck with us was that you really put whistleblowers front and center as people that not only needed to be believed and listened to, but respected and protected. And again, I mentioned this earlier, in some ways, you're blowing the whistle on your own industry, the place where you have your own job. And you're doing it in a way that's much bigger than, say, William Arkin, you know, who wrote a very public letter when he left NBC for the umpteenth time a couple years ago. But what is your position on that? Tell us a little bit about why whistleblowers are so important, and why are people in the so-called news industry just really afraid of whistleblowers, particularly people like Julian Assange?
Well, they didn't used to be. So this is part of the change. This is part of us being subjected to, you know, a lot of whistleblowers are not liked by the political and corporate people that I posit have figured out how to control the news. Before this, in the 2005 time period, 2007, maybe 2000 up to 2010, these stories were very popular with everybody. We were all competing at the networks to get the great whistleblowers with the fascinating inside information and so on. And that stopped, and it became this whole new thing where the whistleblower, instead of being the one that's telling the truth, and obviously a lot of vetting has to be done. I never took someone that just made a claim and put them on TV, so I want to make that clear. But they became somebody that immediately was to be discredited because they're on the wrong side of these interests that I'm talking about. So now the go-to, if someone exposes something, if they're on the wrong side of these important interests, is simply to discredit that whistleblower. And then the press is not going to use them. They're just going to discredit them. So it's almost been like picking apples off of a tree with my program now. We do quite a bit of whistleblower reporting. And I'm not competing for them. I'm finding them, and nobody else wants to talk to them, hardly anybody else, because they don't serve the right interests, and the news is dominated by narratives that are serving the proper interest. So that's my take on it.
Well, so Cheryl Atkinson, what do you make of the press just complete hostility to people like Julian Assange, who seemed to be a liberal darling of sorts after the George W. Bush years, and then has now been wrapped up in the whole cottage industry that was built up around Russiagate?
Julian Assange and Edward Snowden are great examples that I often think of. When Edward Snowden first revealed what the NSA was doing to us and how James Clapper, then director of the National Intelligence, had provided false testimony to Congress about surveilling tens of millions of Americans. When Edward Snowden first came out with his information, we started to cover it those first couple of days. Remember, the Washington Post wouldn't print it, I don't think, so it was published by the British paper and Glenn Greenwald. Mm-hmm. We started chasing that story, and I can almost mark the moment in time at a White House briefing when the special interests, the political interests, or whoever Julian Assange would be hurting, turned the narrative into, where is he? I call it, where's Waldo? Is he in Russia? Is he on a plane? What time would it land if he were headed to Cuba? It's like they threw a shiny ball in one direction and made us chase it instead of looking at the substance. We could have done both, by the way. So that happened with Assange and it happened with Snowden, where we were convinced by these people pushing the narratives to look at the supposed character and the damage done by these people and ignore this really, really important stuff about our intelligence abuses and the intelligence structure and what they've been doing to journalists and American citizens. I remember just watching with my mouth open when that was happening, like, how can the press be so led by the nose to ignore these important stories? And Edward Snowden had a chilling quote. I don't remember it verbatim, but it was something like, his biggest fear after going out on a limb to expose what he did is that even after he basically ruined his own life to do this, that nobody would do anything about it. And I think that happened.
The focus on trivial or sensational items, personalities, Assange's personal life, Snowden's girlfriend, et cetera, et cetera. I like the way you put it, the where's Waldo. Without any tracing of like, well, why did he get stuck where he got stuck in Russia? Well, that goes back to the State Department. Hey, by the way, you mentioned James Clapper a minute ago, who lied with impunity to Congress about this stuff.
Right.
Why wasn't the press really covering that? Why didn't the press go after Clapper, do you think?
I firmly believe this is a theory that I think is supported by evidence and what's happened. There are intelligence operatives inside and outside our news organizations that are able to sway us on all of these things. There are operations that take hold. And you can see the way some reporters who report on the intelligence industry in emails that have come out coordinate their coverage and approve their coverage with some of these intelligence agencies. They're working hand in hand. You can see Clapper and Brennan, despite what they said and did, becoming analysts on cable news after 2016. So they're now integrated into us, into the news. And I think that's, to a large degree, our lack of curiosity on some of these issues we should be following. We're just allowing ourselves to be directed away from it by people that know how to convince us and make us follow breadcrumbs in a different direction.
Well, speaking of Edward Snowden and these kind of breadcrumbs, here's a great quote from Snowden that leads into this final subject that I know you have a lot to say about. Snowden, a couple of years ago, said, businesses that make money by collecting and selling detailed records of private lives were once plainly described as surveillance companies. Their rebranding as social media is the most successful deception since the Department of War became the Department of Defense. So let's get into social media, because you are a fan, and I am too, of talking about how these kinds of companies curate information and influence the news, and even do it in the name of fact-checking to fight fake news. Cheryl Atkinson, some of your remarks on that.
Well, I'd like people to understand that, in my view, big tech companies, yes, they have ideological people who work there, but they had no interest prior to 2016, no demonstrated interest in the really, really heavy-handed censorship that they do. Yes, surveillance and data collection and making money and coordinating perhaps with government in ways that are questionable. But let's talk about the censorship. They were fairly hands-off until they became convinced in 2016 by these same interests I talk about, the political and corporate interests, to insert themselves and do what I call our fake fact checks, curate our information. Well, what drove this in 2016? What drove it is, I believe the interests had quite successfully controlled the information landscape when it came to the news to tell us what to think. But they saw this Donald Trump phenomenon, and they blamed the internet for why people were thinking independently or voting for the guy that they're not supposed to vote for in 2016. And they started this effort. They saw people could still get unfettered access to information online. They didn't like that. Not just political, but scientific studies that they don't want you to see about products and possible dangers and all. So they knew they had to control the internet. But first, they cleverly knew that they had to create the appearance that we would want it. You know, they had to create a market for it. So they told us there was all this fake news out there that was damaging to us. And they told us that it was so bad for people to even hear other opinions that shouldn't be heard. Basically, we invited them to curate our information. We invited them to start these fake fact checks. We kind of have opened the door to let them do exactly what they're doing today. And it's just been 4 short years. They weren't doing anything like this before 2016.
So Cheryl Atkinson, again, as you put it, it's almost as if, well, Congress did ask the big tech social media sector, including Google and others, to do something about, quote, the fake news problem. And of course, we, I guess, as, quote, consumers of news, you know, Mark Crispin Miller, our mutual friend, talks about the problem with news consumption, that it implies that we just suck it in and we don't think about it critically at all. So I have issues with the idea that we're news consumers. But that industry clearly sees us as consumers of information, but that information can be curated and, well, as your new book says, slanted in ways that they simultaneously are telling us that it's for our own good. And what are your thoughts about any kind of an authority, whether it be government or a corporation in the private sector, that's trying to tell us what's for our own good?
Well, I just think people are naive to think, and I have had people in interviews about my book say stuff like, well, there is a lot of bad information that gets passed around on social media and amplified. And I think to myself, like, how do you begin a discussion explaining to people that, guess what? You and I have a right to see fake news if we want to. First of all, fake news or false facts and opinions is in the eye of the beholder. The notion that some third party is not going to get conflicted, or that they're somehow arbiters of everything that's true and good and right, and if they're not going to have conflicts of interest, you don't know who's doing their fact checks. I believe if you want your news curated and you trust those people, whoever they are, you should be able to opt into that service if that's what you want. But I don't think they should be doing it to all of us. And they're almost like these big tech companies, like drug dealers. They got us hooked with the notion that we could go online and share information and access information and be entertained with very little interference. And then they changed the rules of the game starting in 2016. Now we're all hooked. We're all reliant on these companies. We helped them grow so big, we don't know where else to go to do these things. And now they're totally changing the rules. And this grip on information and the censorship is remarkable.
We see censorship in a massive uptick, particularly in the tech forums, and the massive deplatforming of various people. Really a disdain for debate. It's as if we've forgotten how to agree to disagree in many cases, or we've forgotten, if we ever knew, how to logically argue or be inquisitive without being shamed or tainted by guilt by association. So my last question for you, Cheryl Atkinson, author most recently of Slanted, How the News Media Taught Us to Love Censorship and Hate Journalism, as someone that's been a working professional, award-winning journalist for 35 years, where do you see the future of your profession?
I have some optimism because I get contacted every couple of weeks by people who are working on problems that you and I are talking about. And there's three different kinds of people who are calling. There are journalists who are interested in doing straight, factual, fair reporting and figuring out how we do that, you know, in a platform that gets seen. There are technical people like the former co-founder of Wikipedia, Larry Sanger, very smart guy who left Wikipedia in part because it became an agenda-driven, controlled by these agenda editors and political and corporate interests, as a lot of people probably listening know. He's looking for a way, perhaps using blockchain technology and things I don't understand, where we can share information and views and not be deplatformed. So if someone controversializes you or attacks you, it won't matter. And then there are investors. That's the third group. There are people who've contacted me, and they're not looking to make money. They're looking to spend money to help solve the problem. They're saying, where can I put money to help solve this? And I think those groups in the next 4 years will get together and come up with something. There'll be a new paradigm. I don't know what it looks like, but I do think a lot of people are working on that problem and something will come of it. I don't think the main networks and print publications are going to go back to what we once thought of as more unbiased journalism. I don't think that's going to happen.
And I know you're a big supporter, Cheryl Akison, of journalism education, journalism programs and schools. Is there an avenue there? Is there a way we can maybe get back to some of those basics that you seem to be lamenting that have gone?
Well, the problem is, aside from you, I know you're teaching students to be critical thinkers and be the right kind of reporter or look at journalism the right way. And I know there are professors at my alma mater, University of Florida. I'm trying to help fund an award there for students who do this kind of reporting to encourage it, you know, what we're talking about. But unfortunately, there's a professor quoted in Slanted who said how great it was when the New York Times started calling Trump a liar in the headline of the paper. And this professor, and again, cheered on by these journalism watchdog groups as well, said how great it was to end objectivity and neutrality in journalism because they were so overrated. And I argue that in just straight news reporting, it's like a doctor telling you that diet and exercise are overrated. Objectivity and neutrality in journalism, depending on the kind of reporting you do, used to be considered fundamentals. And to have journalism professors now teaching their students in these colleges that those are antiquated things, you're supposed to shove your opinion down the audience's throat, that's pretty scary. And I think a lot of journalism colleges are leaning in that direction. So I guess there's hope at some colleges, yes, and that's important, but are more of them leaning in the other direction?
Well, Cheryl Akison, I appreciate your candor and certainly your reporting and your latest book, Slanted, How the News Media Taught Us to Love Censorship and Hate Journalism. You can learn more at CherylAtkison.com. That's CherylAtkison.com. Sorry for the long spelling there, but I want to make sure people can find the site. Cheryl Atkison, and your show is Full Measure with Cheryl Atkison. It's on Sunday mornings. And Cheryl, I really appreciate you taking time to come on the Project Censored show to talk about the importance of journalism and not only what's wrong with it, but how we need to get back to some of those basics of fact reporting and objective journalism and stop outsourcing our critical thinking to these algorithms and big tech companies.
Well, thank you. And thank you for all you do. You know, maybe we can make some inroads here and there. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Cheryl Atkison. Up next on the Project Censored show, we're going to be joined by Rachel Jolly. And we're going to be speaking about a new report on innovation and a sharper focus, how local news is weathering the coronavirus storm. Up next on the Project Censored show. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of the program, we continue talking about all things journalism, and we are joined by Rachel Jolly, all the way from England. Started her career in journalism as a reporter on the Eastern Daily Press newspaper. She has written for The Times, The Daily Telegraph, The Guardian, and for 7 years, she was at the Index on Censorship magazine as editor-in-chief. And I hope that the people in our audience perk up when they hear the Index on Censorship. Absolutely stalwart work and publication. And Rachel Jolly has done fantastic work there. She is still doing some work with Index on Censorship. But she is also now a visiting fellow in journalism at Sheffield University and a contributing editor at Eurozine. Rachel Jolly recently did a study for Reuters Institute that we're going to talk about today on journalism in a time of coronavirus, from local to global and back again. Rachel Jolly, welcome to the Project Censored show.
Thanks, Mickey. Great to be here.
It's always good to hear your voice and hear what you have to say. This study out with Reuters Institute connected to University of Oxford, Innovation in a Sharper Focus, How Local News is Weathering the Coronavirus Storm. You wrote, newspapers have seen record audiences, rising orders for home delivery, and readers who buy subscriptions for the elderly. So this sounds like we're starting out maybe on a positive note here. Could you talk to us a little bit about what drove you to this study and some of the things that you're finding about what's happening to local news as coronavirus storms the globe? Rachel Jolly.
Well, Mickey, I'm really interested in local news generally because I think it's a really important sector of our media that often gets ignored in the conversation about how our democracy is held to account and how things like local councils and courts work. And all over the world, we've seen local newspapers cutting back staff and cutting back funding. And that does mean they're all under the same pressure. So I was really interested in what was going to happen during the pandemic. Obviously, like the national newspapers, a lot of local newspapers have lost a lot of print sales. But what has happened is they've had massive audiences online. So they've really built up their digital audiences. And I talked to newspapers, news websites around the world, in the US, in Italy, in the UK, Spain. And they've seen so much interest in the stuff that they're writing, which I see as really positive. The Nottingham Post, which is a city newspaper in the UK, has had the biggest audience ever for its website. And I was talking to the editor there and she said, you know, all the restrictions that we're seeing with coronavirus and everything that's going on, all the changes that are going on, people just want to know what that means for them locally. They need someone to cut through and tell them what it all means and what they can do and whether the shops are open and whether the surgeries are open. And all of that stuff means that people are really looking for trusted sources with proper journalism. They're going to call out councils as well and say, well, when you say this, what does it actually mean? So there's a lot of that stuff going on. So in a way, it's positive, but there's still a big financial struggle for those local news sources as well.
So let's go ahead and get more to that. It is heartening to hear people do want to know what's going on around their communities. And I would argue not just because of COVID-19, but maybe especially because of that. There's a renewed interest in this. Let's get to the situation that we're in, because I know you've been looking at this issue for a very long time. What's been happening globally with local journalism as we see more and more conglomerates, big corporations own more and more and buy up and then turn local journalism into more of an adjunct for advertising and PR, or they're closing newsrooms, laying off a lot of people. You write about some of that even here in your recent study about layoffs and the big challenges we have for local journalism. Could you talk a little bit about those issues?
Yeah, I mean, we have seen declining readership for print newspapers, local newspapers, for decades now. And that's not just in one country. That's a worldwide phenomenon. And the consequences for that was that reporting staff got cut. So during the pandemic, as the finance people who own the newspapers are trying to get to grips with the fact that their advertising is collapsing because restaurants are closed and all the shops are closed and they don't want to advertise, of course, because they're closed. They don't know what their future is. But at the same time, there's a huge story going on for journalists. So a lot of those journalists were doing long hours and really committed to doing some work, at the same time being told your job's on the line. You might not have a job in a few months' time. People are looking at different models like subscriber models, and the New York Times has done really well on that. So I was looking at that today. Obviously, they've pushed up their number of paid for subscribers a lot. And that's really helping with their financial situation. And, you know, other people will be studying that as a model and will saying, will that work for them? Other newspaper groups have said, you know, we're not going to have a paywall because we don't believe in that. But then, you know, what are the alternatives?
I want to remind our listeners, you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. I'm speaking with Rachel Jolly. And we're talking about a study recently that she had published at Reuters Institute online. It's called Innovation and a Sharper Focus, How Local News is Weathering the Coronavirus Storm. And Rachel Jolly, people don't really just want packaged, top-down, kind of managed news coming in that way. And whether it's in Europe, if it's BBC or what have you, I mean, not that they don't like that or want that to some degree, but people are really hungry for knowing what's going on in their backyard. And what we've seen, particularly in places like the U.S., is because of this growth of the five corporations controlling about 90% of the media in the United States, there's a dearth of local journalism, what they call news deserts.
That's right.
What are some other ways that you're seeing people restart local journalism? I know a lot of the work that you've done over the years was on local radio, for example, and that's one of the avenues. Can you talk a little bit about that and give some more examples of some things that might be working?
I've also seen things with podcasts. So that's another model where you can keep the costs low. You can actually make it work more easily.
You differentiate some between podcasting versus radio. About the younger generation, everything's a podcast. It's like there's no differentiation. And people are like, well, you have a podcast. And I'm like, well, the Project Censored Show is a podcast, I guess. It does go out into that kind of a platform. But it's actually a radio show that, you know, airs on 50-some stations, Pacifica Network. What's going on right now with that kind of technology around the world with local journalism, with radio?
Local radio, podcasts, it's kind of an interchangeable phrase now, isn't it? And it just kind of depends who you are. I kind of swap them in and out. It depends whether I'm using it on my phone. I suppose it's more like a podcast. Am I actually listening to a stationary radio set, which I still have in my house? Then I think of it differently. But it, you know, it's often the same people doing shows, but sometimes I'm listening to it live and sometimes I'm listening to it 5 days later or something. Clever things can be done with podcasting stroke radio. And we've spoken before, Mickey, about how in countries in Asia, people are putting together clever podcasts that actually can get around censorship in countries like Vietnam, because there's no regulation that had podcasting in mind. So it's possible to, you know, publish things like that.
So I'd like to remind our listeners that you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We're speaking right now with Rachel Jolly, who started her career in journalism as a reporter on the Eastern Daily Press newspaper. She's written for The Times, The Daily Telegraph, and The Guardian. We're speaking right now about a recent study she did at the Reuters Institute. It's titled Innovation and a Sharper Focus, How Local News is Weathering the Coronavirus Storm. After this brief musical break, we're going to talk a little bit more about those findings, and I hope you'll stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of the program, again, we're delighted to welcome back to the show Rachel Jolly, who's a longtime journalist, and she has written for numerous newspapers, The Times, The Daily Telegraph, The Guardian, is in the UK. For 7 years, was at Index on Censorship magazine as editor-in-chief. She is now a visiting fellow in journalism at Sheffield University and a contributing editor at Eurozine. We are now talking about a recent study that she did with Reuters Institute, and we're focusing right now on the importance of local journalism during the COVID-19 pandemic, and we were talking a little bit about radio. Rachel Jolly, in this study, you also talk about some of the challenges you call fighting local spin as one of these challenges, and also something that you've long written about and are expert in, and that's facing unusual hostility and journalists in a time of hostility. Do you want to talk about some of these challenges that you see during our current pandemic?
Absolutely. And I think it's a lot more scary than perhaps people realize, because a lot of governments around the world have used the pandemic to bring in new sets of legislation or a new narrative in terms of stopping the press doing their jobs or inciting hostility against the media, as we've seen in Hungary, in the Czech Republic, in Poland to some extent. Thinking back in March when it was all starting to happen and we were talking about COVID, but we had no idea that it was going to last for very long, I came up with an idea of mapping attacks on media and media freedom across the world, thinking that this would be a project that would go on for, you know, 3 or 4 months maybe, and then we'd wrap it up and it'd all be over. But pretty soon we realized it was actually going to be a huge project, because there was so much going on in terms of types of attacks. So you know, some that I would highlight was in Spain, early in April, over 400 Spanish journalists signed an open letter asking their government to revise a policy, which meant they had to ask their questions in advance, basically have them vetted by the press secretary, who then chose which would be asked, and they weren't allowed to do follow-ups. So you can imagine that really stifles the journalism. The government did roll that back, but it wasn't clear at first of all what was going to happen. In Berlin in May, reporters and camera crew from a TV broadcaster called ZDF were attacked while filming a satirical hygiene demonstration for the channel's Today show. They were attacked by a group of 15 hooded people, some using metal bars and cudgels. The Christian Democratic Union Party's Paul Zemak said on Twitter he was stunned by the cowardly attack on the crew of the Heute show and thus on the freedom of the press. In London, a political journalist called James Cusack for a website called Open Democracy was told he wasn't able to ask questions at a UK government press conference because basically they thought he was the wrong kind of journalist. So a lot of different types of attacks on media freedom, and those are just a few. I mean, there are so many. It's been a real moment to cut back on the press, attack the press, stop them reporting, all sorts of things coming from all sorts of angles, really.
And you had some affiliation here in the U.S. with Press Freedom Tracker. And so we've done some reporting on that here at Project Censored. Just a reminder to folks, if you are not familiar with PressFreedomTracker.us, you really should be. And just since spring, we had COVID hit. And in the United States, there was a mass series of social justice protests related to police brutality after the George Floyd killing in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And we've had nearly 1,000 attacks on press freedom since then. That's a massive uptick in violence.
It really did take off. I don't think that even the people sitting in the US Press Freedom Tracker office saw it coming, because I was talking to them in February and suddenly it went ballistic. They've tracked so many cases and they're very thorough about it. You know, not everything that gets reported to them goes up on the site. It gets verified. There's a whole process going on. And I was just looking at some of their numbers. So far in 2020, there have been 302 journalists attacked in the US, 74 equipment damages, 110 journalists arrested. I mean, I don't think anybody saw that coming in the US or outside. We didn't expect that kind of attack on media freedom in the US this year.
And you write about this in your study. You're seeing an uptick in violence around local journalism around the world as it relates to COVID. There seems to be a lack of trust. It's an online hostility and a public hostility toward journalism. So what are some ways, in your estimation, as someone that studied this problem for a while, what are some ways to overcome this, or ways to change or reshape a public perspective that journalists are actually the problem, or as Donald Trump would say, the enemy of the people?
Well, there's two things here. If the leader of your country is actually articulating the narrative that you can't trust the media, that's quite a difficult thing to overcome, because obviously that's a really powerful voice. And you've seen it with Trump, you've seen it with Bolsonaro in Brazil and Orban in Hungary. There's various of these types of leaders around the world, and they're all using this kind of narrative against the media that the public shouldn't trust them. So that's a real problem, and it's really spiraled in the last few years, hasn't it? I mean, we've just seen more and more of that going on, and it's almost like they're feeding off each other as well, isn't it? But I think what we need to do is we need to talk about some of the really valuable work that people are doing. Well, we talked in the report about some of the hostility that the media were facing and how unreasonable it was. So one editor told me that they had put a video on their website about what was happening in a local hospital that had actually been provided by the hospital itself. And then they started getting, you know, hate mail about how could they do this, how this was wrong. And he would say, you know, it's just incredible that how this kind of vitriol comes at you for no apparent reason. But that's not the only way that people react. I mean, I spoke to a Italian reporter called Alessio Peroni, and he has done a lot of coverage in Milan, which is really the center of the first phase of the pandemic in Italy. And he spoke to a lot of families who had lost someone. And he said he was really surprised by how much people wanted these stories to be reported, and they really wanted to talk about it. And they felt it was really important that reporters were doing this work. And I think we should talk about that more, why people think that's important, even when they've gone through that kind of personal trauma, because I think that's about wanting the world to know what's going on and for things to change and for us to work out as a world population what we should be doing next. But it's all about learning and bringing accounts into the public domain. Another Italian reporter told me how the figures that they were getting on deaths in Bergamo were completely wrong. They were being told the numbers were much lower than they actually were. So they did a whole investigation to get the real numbers out there. I think we need to talk about why those things are important for all sorts of reasons. The sort of healthcare that we need, the sort of reaction that the hospitals need, all these kind of things. How can hospitals and doctors and local councils know how to react if we're talking about the numbers being wrong in these kind of circumstances? So, I mean, this is not only true in the pandemic, of course, but I mean, these are really important arguments and important stories. And I think we should be talking to the public widely about why journalism is important in this kind of crisis, because historically, in a crisis, governments try and restrict journalism. Anyone who studied history will know that to be the case. And we should point that out strongly. This is happening right now.
And this is why we need local journalism to understand and connect the dots globally. And the COVID-19 pandemic is, whether we like it or not, giving us an opportunity, if you will, to really go back and look at what are the consequences of having a dearth of local journalism. The consequences is we have uninformed or underinformed or misinformed populations. And then that in and of itself grows like a virus.
You know yourself how gossip starts circulating, right? And if the only thing you're doing is listening to what's happening on WhatsApp or Facebook or social media and things start going round, we don't know that they're true. They've not been checked out by anyone. And lots of these local journalists, that's what they were checking out, these rumors and this gossip, to see if there was anything in it. You know, and sometimes there might have been, it might have been true, but these things tend to get exaggerated. And you really need someone with some training and some skills and some research time to actually call the council, let's say, and say, what is the case? Has this happened? You know, do you want to people to go to this hospital today and get their vaccine or not? Has this supermarket opened? Have the staff been laid off? Whatever the story, and then report back and say, this is actually happening. This is not just the gossip down your street, which we all hear. We're all on these networks, but we shouldn't rely on too much.
It shouldn't be conflated with actual journalism.
I think we've come through a period where people were conflating the two. And it's good for us to think about what is real information, what is fact-checked information, what sources are the ones that we can rely on.
Well, Rachel Jolly, in the newest Project Censored book, we actually reprinted the Society of Professional Journalists' Code of Ethics. Seek truth and report it. Minimize harm, act independently, be accountable and transparent. You know, the list is long in each of those subcategories, but this gets back a great note for us perhaps to end on as we're running out of time in this segment. You're now a visiting fellow in journalism at Sheffield University. You're getting more and more into academia. Where do you see the future of journalism education as a solution for the challenges we face? And what's journalism look like in the future?
I'd like to see more people getting into journalism with a passion for investigative reporting. I'd like to see us moving on from a period where people wanted to get into journalism so they could interview a celebrity. And I think it's been a bit like that for a while. You know, why do you want to be a journalist? Well, I'd really like to interview Beyonce. I got into journalism because I'd watched some films about investigative journalism and, you know, uncovering some state secrets. I'd like to feel like it was a bit of idealism. There was a bit of a desire to, you know, find out things that people didn't want you to find out. I hope that, like we're seeing a new generation of activists, maybe we'll see a new generation of investigative reporters who really want to get into news and don't want to get into journalism because they think it's a way of getting on the red carpet and talking to celebrities.
Project Censored goes back to the 70s. I know Index on Censorship does as well. The founder of Project Censored, Carl Jensen, once wrote that journalism schools should turn out more muckrakers and fewer buckrakers, and that we'd all be the better for it. Well, Rachel Jolly, I know that we're the better for all of the work you've done over the years. It's always a delight to have you on the program. Rachel Jolly is a visiting fellow in journalism at Sheffield University, contributing editor at Eurozine. For 7 years, she was at Index on Censorship magazine as editor-in-chief, still works with Index, and has written for The Times, Daily Telegraph, The Guardian. The study we've been talking about today is available at Reuters Institute. Rachel Jolly, J-O-L-L-E-Y, if anybody wants to look up the important work, also the work you've done with Press Freedom Tracker, Friends of Project Censored, you're all over doing so many things. Anything you'd like to add here at the end, maybe where people can follow your work?
I've got a new piece out on a website called The Conversation, theconversation.com, another piece about local journalism and the pandemic. Finally, I'd just like people who are thinking about getting into journalism to talk to or read about some of the really amazing work that journalists are doing in countries where their work is censored in a desperate attempt to get reporting out of their countries. Places like Kashmir and Turkey and the Philippines, where they're under incredible pressures not to report what's happening. So if you're thinking of being a journalist, read some of that, and it really, really makes you understand why people want to be a reporter and how important it is.
Rachel Jolly, again, thanks so much for all of your important work. The study that we were referencing today is available at the Reuters Institute website, Innovation and a Sharper Focus, How Local News is Weathering the Coronavirus Storm. I will put on the Project Censored website and social media when this program airs. I will make sure that I put links to the various projects you're working on and your latest work. So Rachel Jolly, thanks so much for everything you do, and thanks for joining us on the Project Censored show.
Thanks, Mickey.
Land supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear this.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show, established in 2010 by myself along with Peter Phillips. I'm the executive producer, Mickey Huff, of this program, also the host, Anthony Fest, our senior producer. Thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
Political ties, habitual eyes, alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics of the apocalypse, got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison, genocide, wars, far for little poison, the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing, all the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, hypnotized by the master thief, combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece, open your eyes and realize what's happening, time's running out to reach all potential, fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love of the brothers in our